This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy. More than 605,000 people have died globally from COVID-19. That figure is more than 140,000 in the United States. There are more than 14.4 million confirmed infections worldwide, with more than 3.7 million in the U.S. U.S. President Donald Trump says he is in favor of Americans wearing face masks to help curb the surging coronavirus pandemic, but says he will not impose a national mandate. He said that I am a believer in masks, Mr. Trump said in an interview at the White House, first aired on the Fox News Sunday TV show. He continued that he says, I think masks are good. Mr. Trump wore a mask in public for the first time only a week ago. Top Republicans in Congress are expecting to meet Monday with President Trump on the next COVID aid package, as the administration panned more virus testing money and interjected other priorities that could complicate quick passage. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was prepared to roll out the $1 trillion package in a matter of days, but divisions between the Senate GOP majority and the White House posed fresh challenges. Congress was returning to session this week as the coronavirus crisis, many had hoped would have improved by now, only worsened, and just as earlier, federal emergency relief was expiring. Australia's acting chief medical officer said Monday, as the country braces for a second wave of infection, that a surge in COVID-19 cases in Australia's second biggest city could take weeks to subside despite a lockdown and orders to wear masks. Authorities in the state of Victoria, whose capital, Melbourne, is in partial lockdown amid a new outbreak, reported 275 COVID cases Monday, down from a daily record of 438 3 days earlier. The Australian acting chief medical officer, Paul Kelly, said it would take weeks to slow the outbreak. This is VOA News. The Chilean government announced a five-step plan for the gradual deconfinement from the pandemic, which will be implemented when certain health criteria are met. President Sebastián Piñera announced the plan step by step after 5 weeks of decreasing infections. Phase one of the plan would be a quarantine, which currently applies to half of the country's population. Within that are mobility restrictions, including authorization for essential activities only, curfews and sanitary cordons to access certain areas, border closures and suspensions of face-to-face learning and education institutes also apply. In a second stage, there would be a transition to reduce the degree of confinement. And the third step, the quarantine is lifted for the entire population except for those over the age of 75, but the curfew and sanitary cordons will be maintained. The gradual return of face-to-face learning in education institutions is authorized in the fourth phase, as well as the reopening of certain commercial activities like cinemas and theaters. The fifth phase includes the free movement of elderly over the age of 75. Curfews and sanitary cordons are lifted, and the return to face-to-face schooling is authorized, still with some limitations. Some top U.S. leaders, House leaders, say that they were alarmed by the Trump administration's tactics against protesters in Portland, Oregon, and other cities, including Washington, D.C., and called on federal inspectors general to investigate. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler, Homeland Security Committee Chairman Benny G. Thompson, and Oversight and Reform Committee Chairwoman Carolyn B. Maloney sent a letter to the Inspectors General of Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security. The Democratic lawmakers want an investigation into the use of federal law enforcement agencies by the Attorney General and the Acting Secretary of Homeland Security to suppress First Amendment-protected activities in Washington, D.C., Portland, and other communities across the United States. The mayor of Oregon's largest city said that the presence of federal agents is exacerbating tensions in Portland, which has seen nearly 2 months of nightly protests since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Twitter says the hack that compromised the accounts of some of its most high-profile users targeted 130 people. The hackers were able to reset the passwords of 45 of those accounts. San Francisco-based company said that in a blog post that for up to 8 of these accounts, the attackers also downloaded the account's information through the Your Twitter Data tool. Twitter said none of the 8 were verified accounts, adding that it's contacting the owners of the affected accounts and saying that we're embarrassed, we're disappointed, and more than anything, we're sorry. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 20th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. There will be more protests today in Mali as activists say ECOWAS mediation does not go far enough.
We see the delegation like a club of presidents who fight to keep president in place against the will of the people. They probably noticed that we are a new generation of African Democrats who want to finally have government by the people and not for the few.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor's ex-wife returns home. Four people have reportedly been killed in Sierra Leone during protests over a power generator. Ugandan activists say virtual campaigns could be a recipe for election violence in 2021. And Tanzania's ruling party defends a second five-year term for President Magufuli.
For the last 5 years, huge developmental initiatives have been taken in Tanzania by the leadership of Chama cha Mapinduzi and Comrade John Pombe Joseph Magufuli.
Humphrey Polepole is the spokesperson for Tanzania's ruling CCM party. And COVID-19 border closings in South Africa pose economic hardships for Mozambicans. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Of the June 5 protest movement in Mali says the group is grateful to the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, for the regional group's efforts to resolve the country's political crisis and for condemning the killing of peaceful protesters. However, Dr. Ramata Sissoko Sisi, president of the Change in Mali movement, says the protesters do not support ECOWAS's long-held tradition of not supporting the removal of a democratically elected leader. An ECOWAS delegation was in Bamako over the weekend for yet another effort aimed at resolving the political stalemate. Dr. Sissoko Sisi says President Keita violated the Malian constitution and therefore must resign.
The delegation met with the president, the prime minister, and our movement, and many other organizations in Mali. What they probably noticed is that the member of our movement, M5, we're not there to claim money, seats in the government or in the parliament, but the desire to rebuild the Malian democracy from its roots. So they saw that we are not here to share the cake, like they say in French, partage du gâteau, proposing seats and different things to the member, because we believe that they based their recommendation on those type of feelings. So we see the delegation as being a group of people who are here to, like a club of president who fight to keep president in place against the will of the people. So they probably noticed that we are a new generation of African Democrats who want to finally have government by the people and not for the few elite.
Dr. Sisi, is it true that the opposition is demanding the dissolution of the parliament and a transitional government?
Yes, because every demand that we made was constitutional. Our first demand is the resignation of the president, especially now that he ordered the killing of 17 innocent peaceful protesters on the 10th, 11th, and 12th of July 2020. These protesters were exercising their constitutional right because it was part of the civil disobedience in a nonviolent protest. Everything we ask after that, which is to dissolve the parliament, is after he resigned, not before. So we want to emphasize on that.
The opposition is demanding the resignation of President Keita. The prime minister has reportedly said that this was an inconceivable demand because President Keita was democratically elected.
We thank the ECOWAS for trying to resolve this problem to come into Mali. And we are thanking them for condemning the killing of the people ordered by the president, who obviously crossed the red line, and the M5 has been clear. We will not sit back in the memory of our martyrs. What we want to add is that we are really shocked by the recommendations of ECOWAS, because these recommendations violated the Malian constitution instead of helping Mali to return to a constitutional state. So the ECOWAS has a red line, they claim, which is not to be able to tell the president to resign. And we have our own red line. So our red line is not to let this president violate the Malian constitution again. So the ECOWAS stressed the necessity of respecting the institution. However, the president himself is the first one who violated them by imposing himself as the president in 2018, when it was clear that he lost those elections.
The ex-wife of former Liberian President Charles Taylor, Agnes Reeves Taylor, returned to Liberia over the weekend from London. Ms. Reeves Taylor was charged with crimes allegedly committed during the Liberian Civil War, but she denied those charges and they were later dismissed. Former President Taylor's political party, the National Patriotic Party, the NPP, and family members say they are planning a program to officially welcome Ms. Reeves Taylor. Some party members have already begun referring to her. Some party members have already begun referring to Ms. Reeves Taylor as the mother of the party. Ms. Reeves Taylor's return comes at a time when the NPP is said to be in turmoil. But Chief Cyril Allen, Chairman Emeritus of the NPP, says Ms. Reeves Taylor did not return to Liberia to enter into politics.
She's been trying to come home, I mean, for the past few months. Even before this incident, she had planned to come back home, look after her property. You know, she has a lot of property. Her brother, who was the immigration commissioner, Lemuel, died. And she's virtually the head of the Reeves family now. Late Vivian Reeves, her father. Her brother died in the States, and the other one died here. So she's coming back now. She has her own personal property and needs to put herself together and organize herself at home and see what contributions she can make in the various sectors, particularly in the education sector, since she is a doctor in two areas and a professor at a university in Southwest London. She may be thinking about considering coming back home finally and making some contributions to the educational sector in other areas of our country.
Chief Allen, you know that we have another woman who carries the name of former President Charles Taylor, and that is Juwahawa Taylor. Now, already I have been reading about members of Mr. Taylor's party referring to Agnes Reeves Taylor as the mother of the party. Is this a likely recipe for rivalry?
No, absolutely not. I'm the chairman emeritus of the party. Joel Howard Taylor is the center bearer of the party, and Agnes, the mother of the revolution, of the MPFL, and that is a closer rule of the MPP, but that doesn't make her the mother. There's no such issue like that. Don't let nobody give you any such scenario. Agnes is not here for any political reason, and furthermore, she and Joel have no risk at all. There are four women, actually, that have, you have Tukey Taylor, also you have his wife, actually, his young wife, Victoria Heston Taylor, who lives in his home, in his house, in home state. So, I mean, everyone, most of the ex-wives have the Taylor name. Agnes does not go by the Taylor name. Actually, she's Dr. Agnes Reeves. So there's a big difference in that, Jimmy. Don't let nobody bring that kind of a necessary distortion of misinformation about rivalry. There's no such thing. The MPP pulls standard bearer in high esteem. And we also welcome our partners, Dr. Agnes Reeves Taylor, back to the country. And there's nothing of such a discussion going on. Please dismiss it completely.
Chief Cyril Allen is the chair emeritus of former Liberian President Charles Taylor's National Patriotic Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Sierra Leone's energy minister says he gave directives to relocate one or two thermal power generators from the northern city of Makini to Longi Airport because Makini, he says, enjoys an uninterrupted hydro generator electricity throughout the year and that the generators have been sitting idle. Makini is the stronghold of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party and home to former President Ernest Bai Koroma. Reports say at least 10 people were killed and 10 wounded over the weekend when protesters tried to stop the removal of the power generators. Authorities say the protesters threw rocks at the police and the army. Afonso Bani is president of the Sierra Leone Human Rights Defenders Coalition. Politically, Afonso, what do you know about Makini? What's the political makeup there? And why do you think that the movement of a power generator could lead to violence?
The issue is that, you know, in the first place, we have to establish the fact that Makini is the seat of the opposition party, the All People's Congress Party, and is where you have the residence of the former president, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma. And so when EDSA, or the government through EDSA, which is the electricity distribution institution that deals with electricity matters, engaged, according to the information, engaged the stakeholders in Makini to relocate the power plant they have, a standby generator, to Lungi. this information was supposed to be communicated. What we don't have very clearly is that whether the stakeholders that were involved in that meeting did use that particular discussion as a political tool to undermine whatever initiative ESA had got to help the community in Lunge for them to have light. We don't know. What we gather was that the day when the incident took place, that people went to Makeni to collect the transformer based on the discussion they had earlier with the stakeholders in Makeni. And the youth went on the rampage that the generators should not be removed from Makeni. Politically, Makeni is the seat of the opposition party. That is where we have the chairman and leader of the party, who is the former president, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma. So any action probably the government is going to take in that area will also be viewed from a political angle.
Afonso Bayani is president of the Sierra Leone Human Rights Defenders Coalition. You're speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 20th. Civil society activists in Uganda are warning that virtual campaigns in the forthcoming elections could be a recipe for election violence and vote rigging. They say the Electoral Commission should allow open campaigns or postpone the elections until COVID-19 has been contained. But Electoral Commission Chairperson Simon Biabakaba says the commission is mandated by law to organize the election within a prescribed time period. Mugumi Davis Rakoriji reports. From Kampala.
Henry Kasacha, a democracy and governance analyst in Uganda, says he worries opposition politicians will be harassed whenever they appear on media platforms.
There's a challenge of spontaneous activity going on. And this takes us back to the issue of violence and all this that may come up. So as the police come up to enforce this no rally, no engagement activity, it may actually be very difficult for them to engage.
Opposition politician Freddy Kasaja agrees.
We have been pulled out of radio stations despite of the fact that we have paid monies colossally to air out our views. And it's going to come. And you tell us that we'll go for vote education through radios and TVs.
Crispin Kaheru, an election analyst in Uganda, says an election where voters and candidates are denied an opportunity to meet won't be free and fair. He says the Electoral Commission ought to have consulted with politicians before coming out with the electoral roadmap.
We seem to conceive campaigns as a one-way traffic, but campaigns are two-way. Political meetings are two-way. People have to ask questions. Have we thought through about the technicalities of how we promote interaction when we choose to go digital, like we've said? But also, I think we also need to learn from the experiences of the other countries that many of the countries that have gone to elections during COVID have suffered very low voter turnout.
Some African countries, including Guinea, Cameroon, Mali, Benin and Burundi, already have held balloting since COVID-19 emerged. Though critics complained of health risks, there's been no indication of voting-related outbreaks. Simon Biabakama, the Electoral Commission chairperson, insists he's simply implementing the law.
What is right in my view is that the Constitution commands us, requires the Commission, that within this specified time, you must conduct these elections, come rain, come sunshine.
Last month, the Electoral Commission in Uganda released the electoral roadmap where it declared campaigns will be conducted virtually to mitigate the risk of spreading COVID-19. Some African countries, including Nigeria, Kenya and Zimbabwe, have postponed elections at some level because of COVID-19 infection risks. A thing activists here say should be considered. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarenji in Kampala, Uganda.
A spokesperson for Tanzania's ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi CCM party says President John Magufuli deserves another term in office, his second and perhaps the last. The party nominated President John Magufuli on July 11 for another five-year term in the coming October election. Opposition parties are holding their own primaries and talking about a possible alliance to choose a single candidate. Human rights groups, including the U.S. State Department, say there is a lack of freedom of the press and political association in Tanzania. But CCM spokesperson Humphrey Polepole says the allegations are fictitious. He says President Magufuli undertook several development projects during his first 5 years in office and plans to do more in his second term.
For the last 5 years, huge developmental initiatives have been taken in Tanzania by the leadership of Chama cha Mapinduzi and Comrade John Pombe Joseph Magufuli. If I am to mention a few, primary and secondary education has moved from not free education to free education. The last 5 years, Comrade Magufuli has managed to build health facilities in Tanzania. From when he took office back in 2015, there were about 77 district hospitals in Tanzania since independence. But Comrade Magufuli has managed his administration to build new 71 district hospitals and about 40 other municipal district hospitals are under construction as we speak.
The party says that it will create 8 million jobs if elected for the next 5 years. Where would these 8 million jobs come from?
You know, for the last 5 years, one thing that we've experienced is we've invested so much in the huge infrastructure development. So that involves a lot of construction in the country. And in the next 5 years, our plan is to even boost the infrastructure development in the country by building more roads, building more factories. We're building dams to produce hydroelectric power. So the construction industry in Tanzania is on the boom.
Your government has been criticized a lot by the Tanzania opposition and human rights groups for lack of freedom of assembly and press. Your response?
First of all, here in Tanzania, we are open to constructive criticism all the time, and we've made that point very clear. What you are saying as criticism on the freedom of assembly and press is fictitious and does not represent the reality here in Tanzania. Second of all, I would like to make this very clear that freedom of movement, freedom of expression, freedom of association, these are constitutional provisions, and I would like to make this very clear that Section 17, Section 18, and Section 20 of the Tanzanian Constitution grant those rights to Tanzanians. And as a ruling governing party, Chama cha Mapinduzi has a responsibility of making sure that the government delivers those rights offered by the Constitution always to our people.
Humphrey Polepole is the spokesperson for Tanzania's ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dodoma. Borders between South Africa and Mozambique have been closed since March. This has created economic hardships for the families of an estimated 28,000 Mozambican miners. They have been able to cross the border to work in South Africa and send remittances to support their families. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Paul Dillon, tells VOA an agreement worked out between the two countries will allow migrants who are properly screened for the coronavirus to resume work in South Africa.
The screening is conducted by the hiring agency, and when they're screened as virus-free, they are then taken into South Africa and quarantined there by the hiring agency for 14 days.
Dillon says the first group of 500 miners has gone through the process and received health checks at an IOM-operated cross-border occupational health center. The center was originally set up to improve the early diagnosis and treatment of tuberculosis, a condition which disproportionately affects mine workers. The IOM spokesman says another 3,000 miners will be screened at the center in the coming weeks. South Africa is the country hardest hit by COVID-19 on the continent. The World Health Organization reports more than 337,500 people are infected with the coronavirus and more than 4,800 have died. This contrasts with only 1,400 reported cases in Mozambique, including 9 deaths. Dillon says IOM has decades of experience assisting its member states with a range of health and border management management issues. He says his agency hopes to use this expertise to create opportunities for Mozambicans with other skills to work in South Africa as well.
South Africa's gold and platinum mines alone employ roughly 45,000 migrant workers, and their skills are considered essential to the resumption of economic activity there. And it's hoped that thousands of migrant workers in Mozambique, including those in the agricultural sector with contracts in South Africa, will soon become part of the same process.
Dylan says IOM staff has been working with long-haul truckers at the Rosano Garcia and Machipanda border crossing since June on ways to protect themselves from COVID-19. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Zambia, where the Zambia Super League resumed on Sunday, one day behind schedule after a match involving leaders Forest Rangers was postponed at the last minute after the hosts reportedly had 28 positive COVID-19 tests from 58 players and staff tested. And later on Sunday, two players each from Zesco United and Power Dynamos tested positive in overnight testing conducted by health officials following Saturday's chaos and have been quarantined. Zambia decided to restart the 2019-2020 season behind closed doors amid a health crisis with 2,810 confirmed infections in the country. Damasio Piri is a Zambia journalist based in Lusaka. He tells me how the first day of football restart went by.
Soccer fans in the country have been eagerly waiting for the league to resume. Fans were glued to their television sets to see if a report of 28 players at Forest Rangers was just a hoax. All the matches were played without fans in the stadium as a measure to contain the spread of coronavirus.
In South Africa, a total of six Mamelodi Sundowns players have been struck by injuries since the club returned to training earlier in the month. Like many other clubs in the Premier Soccer League, the reigning league champions have resumed training after being under lockdown since March. Meanwhile, former Egyptian Football Association president Hani Abarida is likely to run for the Confederation of African Football presidency. That's if the current president, Ahmed Ahmed, decides not to pursue another term, having been elected in 2017. The 66-year-old official, who is also a FIFA council member since 2017, served as the Egyptian Football Association president but resigned following the shock elimination of Egypt from the 2019 African Cup of Nations round of 16. The CAF elections are scheduled to be held in March 2021, and it remains unclear whether Ahmed Ahmed will pursue another term. Staying with football news, Tunisia's Atoul de Sahel and Ivorian striker Soleimani Koulibaly were ordered by FIFA to pay $14 million to Al Ahly within 4 to 5 days or risk facing a raft of sanctions, the Egyptian giants were told on Saturday. Ahly had launched a fresh complaint with the world governing body last month after Atoul failed to pay the $1.4 million penalty imposed on them and Koulibaly over the player's acrimonious exit from the Cairo club in the summer of 2017. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Border Crossings. The Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice.